You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Good morning, everybody. I'm David Walter. I'm a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and I'm here to moderate today's panel about antitrust in the Internet era. We've got a terrific panel here today, and I hope that, you know, through today's panel, all of us will get a better understanding about the importance of antitrust, especially antitrust enforcement in the Internet era. You know, if you look back at the achievements of the Clinton administration in antitrust, certainly their impact on Internet antitrust issues was preeminent. Of course, the Microsoft antitrust case filed by the Justice Department, but also, you know, merger cases that looked at the impact of competition on the Internet. Of course, in the Internet world has expanded tremendously and evolved tremendously over the past 8 years. And the challenges of antitrust of 8 years ago are probably quite different than today. So today we've brought together what I think is really an exceptional panel to address these issues. First, starting on my left, we have Roberta Katz. And I don't think there's anything better than having somebody who has both practical business experience, academic experience, and government enforcement experience. And Roberta was brought in by Christine Varney to be her special advisor on technology issues. Just the kind of special advisor that you need. She was at a note. By the way, the biographies are all in the material, so I'll just be very brief. She was at a number of major high-tech companies, most preeminently Netscape. She then went on to be the associate vice president of strategic planning at Stanford University, and now is at the antitrust division. To my right is Joe Farrell. He heads the economics shop at the Bureau of Economics at the Federal Trade Commission, and is clearly one of the preeminent writers and thinkers on high-tech competition. He had the same job at the Department of Justice during the Clinton administration and at the FCC during the Clinton administration, and it's great to have him back. To his right is Brian Buren, who's the Senior Director for Federal Government Affairs at eBay. That's got to be a terrifically important job. Anybody who has to shop nowadays knows their way to their eBay page, and that'll be $25 for that ad placement, Brian. Brian deals with a wide variety of antitrust and other public policy issues. And then finally, ending things off, is Catherine Sandoval, who's an assistant professor of law at Santa Clara and deals a lot in high-tech policy issues. So let me start things off. Roberta, when I think about when I think about antitrust, I always start at Microsoft. I have no idea why. There's all this effort that you were intimately involved in with the Justice Department bringing that case in the 1990s. So what do you think today, 10 years later, is the importance of the case, and what does it say for the current rules of the road for Internet competition?
Well, I think the primary importance of the case is that we have a lot of companies in existence today that might well not be in existence, but for that consent decree, I think that's one result of the case. I think another was that our society became better educated about technology. The industries, the importance of the Internet, the importance of keeping the Internet accessible, a vision for where technology could go. And the case actually educated the public at a very crucial time. It was a very crucial time in the development of the Internet. People forget that it was only in 1995 that we ever saw anything that said www dot whatever. I remember being at Netscape, and the first time we saw that, we were just awestruck. Well, that's really a very short time ago, given how much commerce is now done via the Internet.
Well, for either Roberta or Joe, since Joe, you worked on the case too,
You know, as I remember that case, part of the theory there was that Microsoft was trying to prevent browser competition because that ultimately might be a threat to the operating system. And if you stop them from doing that, we'd see greater operating system competition. But I'm not sure I see greater operating system competition. Did that work out, and how should we look at that?
Oh, David. So first of all, let me say that my remarks are... including that one, my own views and not the views of the Federal Trade Commission or any individual commissioner, let alone those of the Antitrust Division, where, as David mentioned, I did work to some extent on the Microsoft case. So first of all, the theory of the Microsoft case. The theory of the Microsoft case was not that if we stopped Microsoft from doing certain things, there would be additional operating system competition. The theory of the case was that if we stopped Microsoft from doing certain things, the door would be open for, and there would be a prospect of, additional operating system competition. So it's going too far to try to evaluate the outcome of the case based on whether there has, in fact, been additional operating system competition. But I'd make a broader point, too, about remedies and monopolization cases. As in law enforcement generally, you can't really evaluate the success of a law enforcement initiative by saying, well, have things worked out better in this particular instance, in this particular case? Try applying that to law enforcement on burglary or drug policy or most areas of law enforcement. In most areas of law enforcement, we think of the benefits almost exclusively as deterrence. And although that's not true in monopolization policy, we do pay attention to restoring competition in the instance, it's still true that deterrence and clarifying the rules of the road are very important and can be very, very beneficial.
Well, let me ask you a question, Brian. I mean, one thing that obviously the court struggled with in Microsoft and was quite explicit was how does antitrust sort of respond in internet time? Those of us who like making money as antitrust lawyers, you know, are very comfortable knowing that when we bring an antitrust suit, that it's a full employment suit for like 5, 10, 15 years. Unfortunately, in 5 or 10 years, Brian, the internet may change significantly. So, how do you see this problem of, you know, how fast the antitrust laws can act, and how do you think they should enforcers should respond because of that?
First of all, like Joe said, all these comments are comments of my own. Unless I specifically say this is eBay's view, let's make sure that we understand these are my own personal comments. And I sincerely believe you really, unfortunately, gave my answer with your question. I think that at the 30,000-foot level, probably the most important factor when you talk about antitrust in the internet is that internet time is so fast that and things change so dramatically that it is a tremendous challenge for regulators or for litigators to be able to address concerns in a way that is meaningful in the marketplace. And that's a challenge that I'm not saying I have an answer for, but I think that is probably the biggest challenge, is that business models, is that the internet itself, its power has been to so dramatically shorten the innovation cycle. The cost of scaling a business globally over the internet is so low in a historical context that it's the internet where you can see business models come from nowhere to global businesses in literally just a couple of years. The fact that antitrust regulation and litigation is more like decade-long type of time scales as opposed to year-long type of time scales makes it an extremely challenging place to try to apply the very beneficial antitrust concepts to the internet business space.
Great. Catherine, can you pick up on this? And in particular, if my 10-year antitrust lawsuit that I'm hoping that Joe will bring against my client isn't a good model, are there other approaches that might be considered, such as regulatory approaches, that might be a better way of dealing with some of these issues?
So I'll address regulatory approaches second, but there are actually some examples of courts at least getting to the injunction level, considering motions to dismiss, even motion for summary judgment in any trust cases in less than 2 years, so which is for any trust a rocket docket. But let me pick up on this theme about Microsoft for a second. I think that there are several enduring legacies that have been very important for the Microsoft case. And one of the things in the class that I teach on antitrust law, I always point to the issue of market definition in the antitrust case. And, of course, market definition tends to really define what happens in antitrust case and who wins and loses. What I'm struck by is that I would argue that the relevant market for browsers or for computer operating systems that Microsoft put forward in its case still, I think, is not the relevant market. Because what Microsoft argued is that you have to take into account PDAs, that there's this thing coming from the cloud, that you have to take into account all sorts of other things that compete with the relevant market. And the court defined the market much more narrowly as basically computer operating systems. So one question that I often ask audiences, and I won't necessarily make you raise your hands if you don't want to, but is how many of you, I see a number of you who have laptops, how many of you are willing to completely give up access to a computer, access to a laptop or to a desktop, and rely 100% on a PDA, so on a BlackBerry or iPhone? Okay. Usually when I ask audiences this question, no one raises their hand. And I would argue because still this is a complement, it is not a substitute. And that gets to the heart of market definition. And this also gets to the issue of innovation in the internet age. Yes, there's tremendous innovation, but it still takes a while even for things like that to happen, and this is still a complement, not actually a substitute. And just the second thing I'll say is that also I think that Microsoft had a huge legacy in terms of its finding about Java tools and what Microsoft did that was deceptive. And I think that's been one of the most important legacies that also has come forward in later antitrust cases, is the willingness to look at conduct by companies that is effectively a misrepresentation of the market as deception and as the basis for finding an antitrust violation.
By the way, on that point, by the way, I love to mention things that Joe and Roberta have brought because they can't respond to them. So it gives me free rein to say anything about FTC or DOJ cases. But along those lines, everybody should take a look at the FTC's recent case against Intel, which deals specifically with similar claims similar to the Microsoft claims about deception in the product innovation process and how that could conceivably be an act of monopolization. Let me pick up on something there, which is innovation. Joe, you've written a lot about the field in this area. When we're dealing specifically with high-tech markets, what do we mean by innovation, and how does antitrust enforcement protect innovation in the market?
I'm not such a fool as to try to define innovation. But I think it's worth reflecting on what antitrust and competition policy are about. You can read and hear a lot that makes it sound as if antitrust and competition policy are about giving firms incentives to lower their prices and perhaps in more advanced treatments to innovate. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's part of what they do. But I think in the innovation area, it's perhaps more important to think about competition and antitrust as the enforcer of competition policy as making sure that markets stay open to better new ways of doing things. And that can be true in the technology field. It can be true in the business practices field. It can be true anywhere, really, in the value chain.
Is there some sense in which, Roberta, is there some sense in which the way that the current administration looks at innovation may be different than the way that prior administrations have looked at innovation?
Before I answer, let me give the same caveat that everything I say is coming from me and not from the Department of Justice, and it applies to the previous remarks. I don't I wouldn't be able to say if there's been a difference in how we look at innovation. What I can say is that Christine Varney is very, coming from a career where she was engaged with many technology companies, is very sensitive to the importance of innovation, as I think any good antitrust regulator should be. I totally agree with what Joe said about the role of antitrust in keeping things open for innovators. What you see in Silicon Valley, which is where I've spent a lot of my career, is that venture capitalists will not fund new ideas if they think they will be in areas where there is a bottleneck, where someone can't get access to a market. So the antitrust relationship with innovation is very, very intimate, actually.
Can I chime in on that, David?
Sure.
You know, I'm not going to try to characterize what other people think. That's I'm not going to do that. But in terms of innovation policy generally, from an economic point of view, there are two things to think about. One is incentives, and one is openness and opportunity. And I think different people vary in how they focus on incentives for the few, and one might phrase that as incentives for the incumbents, versus opportunities and openness to many potential innovators. And one of the exciting things, I think, about the Internet is that it's an area where the opportunities for many, many people to innovate, if only in a small way with blogs and so on, but potentially in bigger and more market-shaking ways, the opportunities are open in a way that I think has been rare in the modern economy.
Joe, let me push, and maybe Catherine, let me push on that a little. Openness and incentive, those sound like good things. But what about property? You know, in order for people to really have the incentives to create and come up with new products, don't those property rights need to be fully protected? And aren't there times where antitrust rules may sort of restrict those property rights by requiring access or limiting the ability of firms to exercise those intellectual property rights? And when is the right time for antitrust to do that?
Well, I think, you know, from a narrowly economic point of view, I think the answer to your question is to think about complements and to think about cumulative innovation. And both complements and cumulative innovation have been very important in the Internet. And the fact is that if you protect A's property right on one layer, you may be denying B the opportunity to innovate on a complementary layer. And that is, unfortunately, an unavoidable tension. And there's always a question in public policy of how far you stress the one and how far you stress the other. So that's really the hard trade-off that I think we're facing in that area.
Yes, Catherine?
So the Supreme Court's decision in April of last year in the SBC versus Linkline case really addressed this issue in looking at whether or not there was a duty to deal by facilities-based internet service providers with others who would wish to gain access. And in that particular case, the FCC had actually ordered that the facilities-based ISP, SBC, AT&T had to negotiate with potential independent internet service providers who wanted access, but they didn't mandate that they had to negotiate reasonable prices. So that was actually a price squeeze case, and the court said that there was no price squeeze, but they also really went out of their way to emphasize that there was no duty to deal rooted in antitrust law. Now, this finding was actually based upon one of the things that they cited was the FCC's finding that the internet market was competitive. And I would argue that that is also based on this whole argument about the definition of the internet, where they define broadband as anything over 200 kb in one direction. So, you know, that puts this in the market with, you know, T1 lines and everything else. So you know, this also gets back to the other question that you asked about the role of regulation, because one of the things the Supreme Court mentioned was if you're going to have this kind of opportunity for interconnection, it's going to come from the FCC and from the FCC's mandate to make sure that telecommunications is available in the public interest. Because I think that there are real concerns, both from an antitrust perspective, even without going so far as the essential facilities doctrine, but also certainly under the Communications Act, about the ability of internet service providers, particularly those who control facilities, to throttle access by independent application developers, which are critical to innovation on the internet, to independent service providers, and ultimately to the public's access to content, and often doing this without proper disclosure. So I think that there are some real concerns there that the Federal Trade Commission can address, and that also are rooted in antitrust law, and the Federal Communications Commission is very actively looking at those issues.
Roberta, how do you sort of see the interrelationship between Catherine, I think, has got a number of good points there. How do you see the interrelationship between antitrust enforcement and regulation, and where does that work its way out between the division and the FCC?
Well, there are differences between enforcement and regulation. Enforcement is, in fact, enforcing the law and looking at who is breaking the law and what the consequences of breaking the law will be. Regulation is a much more kind of fluid process, I guess I would say, that involves, as many of you know in this room, input from a lot of directions and an attempt to formulate good policy. So the two are, I think, complementary. The policy is going to lead to law. Enforcers are going to enforce the law. But they really do fulfill complementary functions.
Okay. Well, Catherine, Joe, did you want to add?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are largely, in very broad terms, there are two ways you can deal with problems. One is to try to fix them, and the other is to try to prevent them. And this gets back to David's misstatement at the beginning of the panel. Antitrust does some of each. It sometimes tries to fix problems, but as you mentioned earlier, David, I think in the internet sphere, it may be kind of slow for doing that. And it somewhat tries to prevent problems cropping up through deterrence and clarifying the competitive rules of the road. Regulation, of course, focuses more on trying to prevent problems, but it does it through applying rules rather than by deterrence. I didn't say that very well. It's probably a hard thing to say right. But anyway, I think the basic thing here is not so much antitrust versus regulation as do you try to prevent problems or do you try to fix problems?
Thanks. Brian, Catherine mentioned Supreme Court decisions, and I want to go on to one. You know, by the way, I don't know about you, but I haven't walked into a store for years, and my laptop is my favorite salesperson. But the sponsors of this conference have mentioned to me that if I mention eBay's website one more time, they're removing me as the moderator. There's a recent Supreme Court decision called Legion, which changed the law on resale price maintenance. How does that affect commerce and the internet, and what is it you'd like to see the people in the antitrust agencies do about that?
Well, for background, because I don't know how many folks here follow the Legion decision, which is not often, I think, thought of as an internet antitrust issue, but essentially the Supreme Court in 2007 overturned what was 100 years of precedent where retail price fixing was a per se antitrust violation. We look at the evolution of the retail business in the United States over those 100 years as a fairly positive story, where there's been a lot of innovation, great consumer benefit. And the Supreme Court essentially adopted a view that allowing the enforcement of minimum price maintenance, or we like to call it price fixing, was acceptable and promoted innovation. I actually think this goes back to what Joe just said about the tension between openness to new models versus incentives for established players. And this really tipped the balance in the retail world in the direction of promoting the established versus the interests of the innovators. And we think it was a very negative decision. So first of all, our number one position on the Legion decision is that the U.S. Congress ought to overturn it. And there's legislation in the House and the Senate to do that. It takes one sentence. And it's actually passed the House Judiciary Committee just a couple of weeks ago. We think regulators in the context now of post-Legion, we believe need to be very aggressive in looking at the incentives that established both large retailers and large manufacturers have to try to maintain the dominance of their established business partners and their own business in the face of new innovators. And one other thing that we think Legion points out, Legion was really based on a debate that had gone on over about 50 years in the economics world, in the retail space, about free riding and about whether or not new business models essentially were free riders on the traditional store networks. And one thing I mentioned at the beginning, sort of the internet speed and how much things change, this isn't just in terms of sort of litigation or regulation, but even in terms of academia, I think there's a real need to recognize that things change very quickly in the world, and very often folks who sort of learned their trade 20 years ago need to be aware of the fact that things can change very dramatically when the underlying system changes. Free riding today, you mentioned that the laptop is your, you know, favorite shopping center. The reality is most consumers today use the internet to learn about products, and then they go and buy them in stores. As much as everybody thinks about the sort of traditional idea where maybe somebody goes to a store and then learns all about their product and then goes home and orders it on the internet, when you really think about it as a consumer, where do you think you're going to learn more about the $500 television you're going to buy? From the sales clerk in Best Buy, or by going on the internet and really learning from all the different sources that are out there, all kinds of different consumer reviews, all kinds of different models put out there by new internet businesses in many cases to learn about the product. The reality is almost everybody today goes online to learn about the product, and then in many cases they buy them in stores because of the benefit of being able to return them and things. It turns the whole free rider idea completely upside down. And in 2007, the Supreme Court changes the legal landscape in the antitrust space for retail based on the very opposite idea. And so from our perspective, one of the takeaways would be we need to be aware of the fact that the internet can change those kind of fundamental ideas, which can totally change the sort of the intellectual basis for these kind of issues. So we would like to see Legion overturned.
Catherine, do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah. And I think for all of us as consumers, you need to ask yourself, who do you want to determine prices? Do you want manufacturers to determine prices and say to retailers, thou shalt not sell this phone for less than X amount, thou shalt not sell this pen for less than X amount, or would you rather have retailers determine prices? You know, it's very interesting because of this decision, one of the things that you see is things like iPods never go on sale. You know, you can go to many different stores and they sell for within a dollar of each other, $5 at the most. There's very, very little variance. And what this case says is that before it was per se illegal to engage in these types of relationships. In Europe, it is still per se illegal to engage in these types of relationships, and Europe still considers it price fixing. It is subject now to a rule of reason analysis in the United States. But I think one of the things that you point out is that also the court said one of the factors that we need to look at in the rule of reason analysis is what is the source of the restraint? Because increasingly what is happening is that traditional retailers are asking manufacturers to impose resale price maintenance to try to restrain competition from the internet. And I think that that is anti-competitive and should be scrutinized very strictly under the rule of reason.
Yeah, I think this case, you know, and the example here that Brian brings up, it just sort of creates a great example of why the internet is just, you know, a tremendous tool for consumer sovereignty. And consumer sovereignty is the key to the free market, consumers having choices and adequate information. In traditional markets, that doesn't always work. But the proliferation of information through the internet really does enhance consumer sovereignty in a significant fashion. And the history of antitrust enforcement is really of people who don't like to respond to consumer sovereignty in one fashion or another, perhaps by, you know, engaging in price fixing, perhaps by engaging in other restrictive activities, so on and so forth. So speaking about people who don't like competition, Roberta, Ticketmaster has gotten the green light to acquire Live Nation. And when I took antitrust, this was a long time ago, but I thought that merging two Goliaths weren't good for consumers. These seem like two big Goliaths. So why did the Department of Justice let this merger go through, and how is competition going to be protected through the Justice Department's action?
So to quote Joe, oh, David. this is not... when you say it as a green light, this is a green light that has many protections that go with it. Let me just say that the merger as presented was, we believed, anti-competitive. And we looked at it. We were prepared to litigate on this merger. The parties worked very closely with the Department of Justice and presented remedies that, when all was said and done, the department and the division felt would protect, preserve competition in this space, and perhaps even enhance it. As has been in the press in the last couple of days, the remedies are both structural and behavioral. It's a combination of remedies. Ticketmaster, well, the merged entity will have to divest itself of one whole ticketing platform, and we'll have to license the primary Ticketmaster platform to a large, also behemoth, who will hopefully be able to use this ticketing functionality now to be fully competitive with the merged entity. But it's important also to look at these behavioral remedies, and they include anti-retaliation remedies. They include anti-bundling remedies so that the new merged entity cannot bundle all of its existing services in order to, in essence, coerce someone to use their ticketing. It also includes some provisions to protect data that will come from the ticketing process. So it's a green light that says go with caution. And we will be watching very closely to make sure that these remedies are respected.
Great. Brian, one of my favorite places to buy tickets is at StubHub. So for those people who – I thought I'd slip that in quickly, and hopefully nobody would.
On the Internet, you get about a quarter of a cent every time you mention something. So
okay.
I will have my book at the end.
Excellent. So it's one of those placement ads on the side that, you know, we miss. Okay, so I don't see much here in the Ticketmaster action involving secondary market, which is an important place for people to buy tickets when they don't want to deal with Ticketmaster. What's your perspective on that?
First of all, we don't have a position on the recent decision of the DOJ, and so I won't be commenting on that, although I do believe it's probably worth noting, and I think Roberta would agree with me, that while most regular people, most ticket consumers, might think that they're the customer of Ticketmaster, but I think there's a number of years now that government regulators have made it clear that the customers of Ticketmaster are venues and teams and artists and people who actually use their services. And so from that perspective, the decision attempts to address that by offering more potential competitors to Ticketmaster with a very limited audience. Unless you own a team, you're probably not likely to be involved in that sort of economic relationship. From the eBay perspective and StubHub, we really focused on the services that actual fans use. And I think this is, again, I kind of like these hour-long panels because you end up with a couple of themes that hopefully come out. And this is another one where I think going back to behemoth versus new entrants and the sort of balance between the different interests. This is another one where our perspective really comes from the side of new entrants and the smaller players versus the behemoths. And we think going forward that maybe that's most relevant in the secondary market for tickets and the way the Internet. I mean, Ticketmaster, honestly, is not an Internet company. although like every company, I'm sure their people use email, and they're all together networked on the internet. But the innovation in the ticket space with the internet has been the ability for fans to buy and sell tickets over platforms like eBay, like StubHub, and there are many others, including platforms that have been owned by, and I think still are owned by, Ticketmaster. We think it's very important that the new business not be able to leverage their dominance in the services that they offer the teams and the artists and the venues into control over that secondary market, where fans and other small businesses and innovators are able to serve consumers in a very positive way.
By the way, I should have disclosed the fact that I represent groups, including consumer groups, that oppose the merger. And just to give you an idea of the importance of the internet, what we did is we created a website called ticketdisaster.org, which you can go to right now, and then solicited consumers to send in emails to the Justice Department. Joe, don't worry. We're going to find a merger of yours to do this with. And we, over 25,000 consumers sent emails to Christine Varney objecting to the merger. Let's spend a second, a little more on Ticketmaster. It's interesting, these non-discrimination provisions and the anti-bundling provisions. Joe, how do you see, are those provisions that the FTC will consider in an appropriate vertical merger case? And generally, do you see vertical merger enforcement being more careful than in past administrations?
Well, first of all, as to Ticketmaster, my experience in government service is that you're fairly busy, and so if it's not the case that you can't comment because you know too much, it's the case that you can't comment because you don't know enough. And I would certainly find myself in one of those categories. So as to vertical mergers generally, again, I'm not going to try to characterize other people's positions. My view on vertical mergers and vertical restraints, and I would include resale price maintenance in this, by the way, and we can talk more about that if you want, but I think you've wanted to move on. My view on that is it's actually quite helpful to be guided but not hamstrung by the Chicago School economics approach to vertical restraints. And that approach basically says if a vertical restraint caused mischief, then there's somebody in the vertical chain who wouldn't want it. And so in the hands of the Chicago School, to the extent that that's still a reality and not just a slogan, that observation has sometimes been given too much weight. But I think it is important to give it some weight. And in particular, I think it's a helpful analytical framework to ask yourself if that doesn't apply in a particular case, if you think that mischief is going to happen notwithstanding the fact that somebody complementary in the value chain wants to resist mischief, why is that? And so my own view on vertical restraints and vertical mergers is you want to be reality-based and not base it on slogans. That involves taking the Chicago School argument seriously but not credulously.
Great. Catherine, and I want to hear from Roberta about this too. What are the circumstances in which antitrust should lead to an obligation for a dominant firm to aid a competitor? And certainly if you look at Joe's hamstrung on this one, if you look at the complaint in the Intel case and the section on remedy, there certainly seem to be a lot of provisions there that say that in the future, if the, Intel's under an obligation to sort of assist their rivals, and that is also criticized quite strongly in the response of Intel. So, Catherine, what are the circumstances where antitrust should require that?
Okay, great. Well, let me just say something real quick about one of the things that I think that that Brian mentioned that was important with regard to Ticketmaster is the whole tension in antitrust about who is the customer and whose interests the Department of Justice, in particular, and the Federal Trade Commission should be looking out for. Because I think often when we view the customer as the advertiser, the customer as the venue, that we lose sight of the fact that antitrust law was adopted to protect competition, to protect democracy, and to protect consumers, and that we always have to keep the consumer interest in mind. And I think the FCC actually does a good job of that. So with regard to the obligation to aid competitors, one of the things that I think is I've characterized the Supreme Court's recent antitrust decisions as adopting a view of competition that is increasingly nasty, brutish, and short. It is quite Hobbesian. You know, they've said things like even an act of pure malice by one competitor against another is not necessarily anti-competitive. They have, you know, there have been certainly lower court cases that have recognized things like some of Microsoft's conduct with regard to Java tools as deceptive, and there have been a few other deceptive conduct type of cases. And I think that the reason I say that it's short is that their hope is that innovation will take care of all of these things. But the court has been very, really reluctant to recognize circumstances in which there is a duty to aid competitors. Some of the cases in which they have recognized those circumstances, like the Aspen Seeing case, have been rooted on a finding of monopoly power. And this is part of what's so important about this Intel case, an Intel settlement with AMD, where Intel agreed to pay AMD $1.25 billion to settle AMD's antitrust case. The European Commission has fined Intel $1.45 billion for alleged antitrust violations. And Intel controls more than 90% of the chip market, the x86 chip market, that I'm sure powers most of your laptop computers. One of the things, though, that Intel is really fighting about with regard to the Federal Trade Commission's case is that the FTC also brought allegations with regard to graphic chips, where Intel does not actually have monopoly power. In Europe, it might be classified as having dominance, but it doesn't have monopoly power in the United States, which really puts it in a different category. Now, the FTC's case is actually based on the FTC Act and not the Sherman Act, so it's going to be a very interesting test of what is the actual boundary between the FTC Act and the Sherman Act. The Supreme Court has previously recognized that the FTC Act was intended to be broader than the Sherman Act. But I think the Intel case, you know, the facts are really interesting. And, you know, they are alleged to have done things like basically said, you know, if you buy 90% of your requirements from us, the price is this. If you only buy 70% of your requirements for us, the price goes up and up and up. The more you buy from us, the cheaper it is. You know, so there's some very interesting allegations that certainly the European Commission has found are rooted in tying and various other types of anti-competitive behavior. So I think it's also a real signal to firms, in the same way that Microsoft was, that they can't just count these types of things as the cost of doing business, but that they really need to take them seriously as antitrust violations.
Roberta, the obligation to aid your competitor.
I think it's important to recognize that in an antitrust enforcement, the enforcers are looking at the facts of the case. And as Kathy just said, the facts matter. So in every case, the whether it's a transaction or an allegation of some other wrongdoing, or an allegation of wrongdoing, or if we're looking at a merger, you have to look at the facts in front of you, what is being presented, and of course have a backdrop, a sense of the context, whether it's the industry or sort of just the setting of the economy. And if there is a violation, then a remedy is going to be crafted to remedy that violation. Sometimes that might entail a remedy that would, in fact, help a competitor. Sometimes it wouldn't. So it's hard to generalize. Every matter is going to be looked at on its own terms. Every remedy is going to be looked at on its own terms.
Why don't I open things up to the audience, see if people have questions. There are microphones right here. I'd ask that you'd identify yourselves and ask questions. I know people in Washington love to give speeches. That time starts at about 12:30 during the lunch break. So if people have some questions to ask, thank you.
Hi, my name is Jonathan Zook, and I'm with the Association for Competitive Technology. And I will do my best to craft this into a question, I guess, to some extent. But you just got done saying the facts are important, and I feel like the facts that get ignored in the Intel case is ever-falling prices in the processor market, the fact that there's big market share changes when one innovation happens over another, et cetera. And those facts, I think, when talking about consumer harm, ought to be treated with equal importance as activities that, in the case of Europe, are per se, I'm not a lawyer, but per se violations of antitrust law. And so what about addressing all of the facts and not just some of them, I guess, is my question.
Great. Catherine, would you like to start in responding to that?
Right. So I don't know what Joe can say about the Intel case, but I think that those facts are very important. And again, I would emphasize that Intel should really think about the situation Microsoft was in with overwhelming market power, and that the allegations are that they've done a variety of things to basically protect their market. I think it's a very important lesson, and one of the things that we've talked about is it's a lesson to business people also that there are there's antitrust limits to what they can do to try to market. And I think that this case is running up against some of those limits. Now, they don't have monopoly power in all the markets, but I think that, a number of countries have made findings against Intel, South Korea, Japan, the European Commission, now we have the FTC filing. I think it's a real warning that businesses need to take these practices very seriously, and that you need to be aware of when you're doing something which actually would, saying, I will charge you less if you buy all or a large portion of your requirements from me, sounds like, walks like, looks like tying and various other antitrust violations. So I think it's a very serious issue.
Yeah, it sort of reminds me back in 1998, as I recall, when this Microsoft trial was going on, a lot of people said, hey, price of operating systems are going down, and Microsoft, even though the monopolist, consumers weren't suffering. By the way, on Jonathan's point, you should look at Intel's reply to the FTC's complaint, which documents that. But look, in antitrust terms, the question is, what's the but-for world? But for Intel's practices, what would have happened? And the complaint says, the FTC complaint and the European decision both document it at some length that Intel appears to have been a technological laggard and faced with losing the technology battle with AMD, engaged in a lot of strong-arm tactics with OEMs that sort of kept AMD from winning the technology race. You can imagine, thinking back to Roberta's point about venture capitalists, that if you're a venture capitalist in another environment, not this specific environment, but in another environment, and you see this history of practices, are you really going to give money to the next Intel, knowing that a firm can engage in those types of practices? Yes.
Thank you. Steve DelBianco with NetChoice Coalition. And Kathy, you brought up that critical question of who's the customer. And when you guys began to talk about the Ticketmaster merger, I know David transitioned from that primary market to that secondary market, where who's the customer is very clear. The customers are people that own a ticket and want to sell it to somebody else, or I'm seeking a ticket. So in that case, the venue and the artist are sort of out of the picture. And yet that market is one where innovation that Ticketmaster wants to do in the way of electronic tickets or paperless tickets kind of locks those customers out of having any choice about the exchange they use and how they do their tickets. Because if it's an electronic ticket, the only way I can buy and sell it is through the guy who issued it, and that's Ticketmaster. So the question is, how did we possibly miss the opportunity to add that as a merger condition? that Ticketmaster would have to make their electronic ticket market interoperable so that competing exchanges would offer customers a choice as to where and how to sell their tickets. We missed that opportunity, and it may have been because we allowed the parties to propose the conditions, but isn't it our role to also impose additional conditions that preserve customer choice and competition?
Roberta?
You know, I, as I said before, each case, when you're doing law enforcement, each case is on its own terms, and the market that was presented in this merger was primary ticketing. We are cognizant of the issues in secondary ticketing. They were not in front of us.
Yeah. I mean, just to be more, to amplify on that, perhaps, as I understand the mission of the enforcement agencies, it's to look at the specific merger and question whether or not a certain course of conduct is merger specific. In this case, Live Nation had no secondary ticketing operation, and perhaps one reason why that didn't get more attention was because there wasn't a direct overlap in secondary ticketing.
I mean, it's actually good that law enforcement is limited to what's in front of it. You can imagine the ramifications if that weren't the case.
Okay. David? Yes. You know, I think your question also brings up the whole issue of secondary markets and aftermarkets. So in antitrust, we have this concept of aftermarkets. You know, is there competition in the foreign market, such as competition to sell tickets for the venues? And is there competition in the aftermarket, such as StubHub is a great example of aftermarkets. So just wanted to diverge on that for a second in talking about the internet and especially aftermarkets. You know, I was saying that the Supreme Court rested on the FCC's assumption that the internet market was competitive. And so one of the arguments about looking at certain types of wireless phone companies, for example, is that the wireless market has been held to be fairly competitive in the United States. But I think there are some really interesting questions about aftermarkets, including the aftermarket for applications. So one of the themes that I've written about, and this gets back to the disclosure issue, I'm actually doing a study right now looking at what are the terms of service that internet service providers have in their contracts as compared to what have they promised consumers. So I wrote an article which addressed some of these issues. It's called Disclosure, Deception, and Deep Packet Inspection, the Role of the Federal Trade Commission Act's Deceptive Conduct Provisions in the Net Neutrality Debate. But one of the things that I found is, for example, iPhone, the only data plan you can buy from them is an unlimited data plan. Okay, you can't buy a cheaper plan. The only plan they have available is an unlimited data plan. There is nowhere, so I have scrutinized their terms of service, and then I had a student working with me, my research assistant. We called, went through three different levels of customer service, and they admitted that there is no term in their terms of service that says that you can only download the applications that they approve on the internet. Okay, so how is unlimited access consistent with you can only download what we approve? And then actually a really interesting issue too. So, and then one of the things that ultimately the third level of customer service rep said was, well, people should know that they can only buy from us. How should people know? You don't tell them. And you tell them, in fact, that what they're getting is unlimited, and it's not unlimited, you know, which is an issue, I think, both in terms of competition and also a huge issue for consumers and for deception. But when you think about competition also, consider something now like Google's new phone. So the Google also is hosting applications. Well, one of the interesting issues is all those apps that you may have downloaded and paid for on the iPhone, they're not portable. So if you want to switch to the Google phone, guess what? You got to download and pay for the apps all over again. So, you know, it's raising very interesting issues about aftermarkets. And what's been fascinating is there are some cases that say even when there's competition in what we call the fore market, there can, in fact, be monopoly power in an aftermarket that can allow the courts more scrutiny about, and basically to apply different rules in looking at some conduct with regard to aftermarkets.
Joe, do you have any observations to add about how, you know, antitrust enforcers should look at this aftermarket issue?
Yeah, I mean, I think the question of whether there can be monopoly power in an aftermarket is perhaps needs to be unpacked. And in particular, as I was referring to a few minutes ago, there is an idea associated with the Chicago School of Economics that even if there's monopoly power in an aftermarket, a firm won't want to abuse that power because of the repercussions it would have on the foremarket. And that, by the way, as a matter of analytical economics, is true whether or not there's competition in the foremarket. So even for a monopoly in the foremarket, that would be an observation to think about. One of the ways in which that argument can fail, and there are a number, is if consumers don't see at the time of their foremarket transactions what's going to happen in the aftermarket. And so consumer information failures, whether or not due to reprehensible misrepresentations or concealment, consumer information failures concerning what's going to happen in the aftermarket are one of the ways that you can get problems arising, notwithstanding this Chicago-style linkage. And I think that's pretty important and could easily be an important part of what we need to think about in net neutrality.
Okay, I've got final questions here. You're all limited to 1 minute. Brian and Catherine, tell me the most important thing the agencies can do in the next year on internet competition.
I think look at these disclosure issues with regard to, you know, are companies giving consumers and also those who use the internet in terms of applications the opportunity to be eyes wide open? Are they telling us what's going on? Because one of the other things that Joe was saying is that what can lock you in is not only information failure so that you have no idea when you go into this that you're going to be locked in through your unlimited plan to only downloading what they approve, but that there are also various charges, some of which you know about, some of which you don't, which lock you in and deter substitution. Whether it is things like, basically liquidated damages fees, we know them as early termination fees in the cell phone world, that they won't let you switch even after your contract is over. Other things that keep you locked in, I think, are things that we have to be concerned about because they deter competition and hurt consumers.
Brian.
Okay, 1 minute. Number one, focus the efforts on business practices and technology uses to close off new entrants. Number two, recognize the fact that the internet is changing many of the underlying markets and even sort of market concepts that drive a lot of this analysis, so be willing to change. Number three, recognize the limitations of the Chicago School of Economics in the economic analysis, in particular in the space of retail price fixing. And number four, for the regulators, work really long hours because time is short and you need to get a lot done.
Brian, that's great. Okay, now turning to Joe and then ending up with Roberto. A year from now, what do you want the people in this audience to be able to say about what you've accomplished in the last year related to internet competition?
I'm not going to lay out an agenda. I think I would pick up on something that Kathy stressed, which is consumer information. It's very empowering, not only directly, but because knowing that consumers will react to changes in product quality, innovation, changes in price, terms of service, that dramatically strengthens competition. And so one of the reasons that I'm excited to be at the Federal Trade Commission is we have the dual mission of competition policy and consumer protection, which includes, although it's not limited to, consumer information. I'm a big believer in the resonance between those two missions. I think, in particular, consumer information initiatives can really help to spice up competition. On the other hand, it's not as simple as just saying we need more disclosure because, as you all know, if you see a 15-page click-through disclosure when you go to buy your tickets on StubHub or pretty much any other transaction, unless it's buying a house or something, you're probably not going to read it. Or if you read it, you'll discover that it was written by a lawyer and you can't quite tell what it says or how it's going to be interpreted. So there's a lot of both science and art that goes into disclosures. They're not a magic bullet. I think they can help a lot, but we need to explore how to make them work best and what to do to the extent that they may not be enough.
Roberta, you get the last word.
Oh, the last word. I mean, one thing that's been talked about on this panel is that applying the law in the context of the internet and rapid change is difficult, and it requires being open to what is happening, being aware of what is happening. I think under Christine Varney, the Antitrust Division has invited people to come talk to us to give us a broad perspective on what is happening with a strong appreciation for innovation. I hope that within 1 year or at the end of 1 year, people will look at what the Antitrust Division has done during that year and said, these people have applied the law, have enforced the law with a combination of intelligence, awareness, efficiency, and effectiveness.
Well, let's give this panel a great hand for today's illuminating remarks. The lunch, I believe, is someplace over there, and stay for the rest of the program. Thanks.